tonight have been prepared by audience participants and given to league members to give to me. The goal is to ensure a variety of topics are covered. So we'll start first with Brian Holst. Please tell us about yourself and why you're running for school board.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everyone. Brian Holst, and running for school board out of a great interest in serving our community. I also want to say a big shout out to my folks' 53-year anniversary tonight. So thanks to Butch and Janice. They brought me here and the family in 1978 as a Coast Guard family. I have married my wife, Estella. We have four children in the school system now, two in Harborview, one in Santikihini, and my oldest at Juno Douglas High School. I'm also a graduate of JDHS in 1984. You know, education can and should be one of the great equalizers of opportunity in our society. I think preparing every student that enters our schools to lead a productive life is critically important. Thank you.
Thank you. Sean?
Hi, I'm Sean O'Brien, and I'm a lifelong member of Juno and been involved with a variety of community volunteering. Have Sue, my wife, and I have five children from 15 to 29 years old. I've been involved in three different schools at site council levels and volunteering for about 20 years. The school board has just been an extension of my community service. This is will be my third term if I'm reelected. We have some really challenging times ahead of us. Requires a lot of work and a lot of knowledge across the district. We're making progress, and I'd like to have the opportunity to continue that progress. Thank you.
Thank you. Tom?
Yes, hi, Tom Milliron, and I'm a write-in candidate for the school board. And by the way, you have to fill in that little oval next to the name, too, just so I toss that in there. I'd like to start by thanking the league and K2 for making this opportunity possible. I'd like to also thank Sean for telling me that as a write-in candidate, I needed to put my last name on the name tag. I think that was a very good point. So I redid my name tag. I'm a lifelong educator. Had the privilege and honor of working with the kids in our district and our community here in Juno for the last 17 years. Prior to that, worked in Chatham School District, Southeast Island School District, taught at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Florida State University. Boy, go Seminoles. I don't know if you've seen any of those games this year, but they are nail biters. I'm here to give choice to the community. I'm sure Sean and Brian will thank me for making this opportunity possible for us, but I decided to be a write-in candidate when we discovered there were only two candidates for two seats. Thought it would be good to get the issues out there and give choice to the community.
Great, thank you. Our first question tonight is going to start with Sean. With public school enrollment down, what would you do to increase enrollment and graduation rates?
Well, there's a function between the attractiveness in our school district and parents and families coming in, so I think it's a two-prong answer. First, we need a high-quality school system to attract families and therefore kids to our district, and we need to continue moving forward with high-quality performance, high-quality academic achievement, and high-quality schools. So I think the first part of the answer is you absolutely have to develop, maintain, and grow high-quality schools. It will be an attraction. The other aspect, of course, is, and this is more the assembly issue, but we certainly have a lot of challenges with keeping and attracting families in Juno based on a lot of challenges socioeconomically, high cost of housing, and so on. And I know there's a lot of effort and work going into that. But to really have a solution to attract people to Juno, there's got to be a comprehensive approach both on the socioeconomic housing and job side as well as on the quality of education. So that's really important.
Thank you. Tom, if you'd like to respond.
Well, just a couple comments to follow up on what Sean said. One way we can create that really high-quality, world-class school system is by creating the best working environment for our staff, and that includes classified, certified, and for our community members. Once we have just the best working environment possible, a true unified school district with everybody working together in partnership, then we gain that reputation that will attract top quality staff from throughout the state and nationwide. The staff, when it boils down to it, it's the teacher in the classroom that makes the difference, regardless of the curriculum. I mean, that's not the downplay curriculum, but it comes down to relationship building. It comes down to teacher efficacy when we're looking at increasing student achievement.
Thank you. Brian?
Thank you. High-quality schools attract families and employers into our community. I'm really glad to see that immediately we can make the next connection between the economy and our schools. It requires a really important investment by our community, into our community, and the payoff is that we'll have a more vibrant economy. So I think that's one way of bringing in, making our schools more attractive. But the graduation rates is also really critical. We've seen some progress in the last several years of where graduation rates have gone up. I feel it's a little bit tenuous now. We have some challenges ahead of us. We have students that we have raised our graduation requirements, and we need to maintain the support to those students so that we can maintain those graduation rates.
Thank you. Next question goes to Tom. What are your thoughts on charter schools and other alternatives within the public school district?
I think we need to offer as many options as possible within the public school funding system for our kids, especially kids that may not thrive in the more traditional classroom. But that's not to say just students who aren't thriving in the traditional classroom. Charter schools, and especially depending on the charter focus, is a magnet for many kids across all stratas. So I'm a supporter of charter schools. I believe, of course, the process should be followed, the school board involved, the community involved, and to just to ensure we have the best possible charter school available for our kids.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. I also support the charter schools. I think there is options are important. I think we could look at, it's one way of addressing particular interests and needs. For example, there could be a need and interest in STEM schools. I think we should look first at trying to make sure that some of these needs that parents perceive and families perceive can be met through our current system. And if that's not possible, then we need to look to charter schools. I also think it's really important to look at buildings, our schools that exist. You know, alternative high school, I think we need to look at that in terms of the facilities that we've provided to those students and make sure that they're also getting the same level of support that others are in our district. And I think that needs to be done in conjunction with any decision that we would make about expanding, adding additional schools into our system.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have and will continue to support options, including charter schools and Juno and across the district. I think for me what's compelling is it's a big puzzle when you talk about what's the best menu to create for our kids and our parents to select from. And that menu is like a puzzle. It needs to fit together. So if we're talking about charter schools or Montessori or Homebridge or how some of the district programs fit in, online classes, Plato, et cetera, there is a need to make sure that there's a system in place. And just because you have a school outside of the system like charter doesn't mean it we're off the hook for being a partner in collaboration and making it fit. That's a challenge because clearly charter has a different culture and a different approach towards how they operate their schools. And I know we've been really active on the school board and will continue to be active to try to make that puzzle fit together. So Juno and her families aren't looking at some fragmented system where it's competitive instead of cooperative. I think it's really crucial. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, Brian, you'll start with this question. What health care do students need at school?
What health care do students need at school? I think we have a strong system of providing health care at the schools. I think this might be directed towards the question around nurses, or again, maybe I can choose to go there as well. I think we have, given the budget constraints, there's been a decision to change the way those each of our buildings receives those nursing services. And I think the I understand why that decision was made, but I also think we need to be very careful about that decision, not having specifically having a nurse in every building. I do think we have professionals in every building, and I understand that that this new model is working well. But I think there are a lot of students in our community, a lot of families that by having an option to have a nurse or a trained person close by can help them to be more productive, avoid being ill, and then have a more improved, better chances of having better educational outcomes.
Okay, thank you. Sean, first one.
Sure. So prior to the changes and the budgetary constraints that we've had, Juneau's had the luxury for a long time having one nurse in every school. It was that way when I went to school there. It's been going on for a long time, and certainly has been an awesome resource to have. The current model is one nurse shared between two schools and then one health aide at every building at every school. And as a school board member, we're obviously really concerned. I mean, the safety and well-being of our kids is preeminent. So we had to watch that real closely. We've continued to watch that model and see it develop. It seems to be moving along. There have been some challenges along the way, for sure, but like anything that's implemented, it has to be implemented with fidelity and high quality. I believe that if that occurs, that if that model is implemented with high quality and fidelity, that we can make that model work. So that's my position.
Great. Thank you.
And I, too, will take it straight to the nurse question, okay? But before I'll present a qualifier, really it begs the budget. How do we handle the budget? First and foremost, the budget should reflect two priorities. First of all, the non-negotiables, if you will, that our school district leadership deems critical to the success of our mission. The second item that should be in the budget then would be the priorities of our community. If our community prioritizes nurses in every school over another budget item, that should be reflected in the budget. But having said that, my personal position, after working in schools with nurses and without nurses and with health aides, is each of our schools needs a nurse. It's a huge difference, not just for our parents and kids, but for our staff. Unless you're in the office and in the environment, it's difficult to understand the impact it has when we do not have nurses available. It just eats up our time.
Okay. Thank you. This next question is for Sean and Brian, and Tom, if you would like to address it again. What can be done to improve civics education in the Juneau schools? And we'll start with Sean.
You know, I think first and foremost, that civics has to be embedded, like kids can understand and relate to it, so they can get out in the community and take on community volunteering, community service work, get, for lack of a better term, a real taste of it. It's one thing to read it in a book and hear from a teacher that it's the right thing to do. It's another thing to go out and practice it. So I think it's embedding civics into a real, relevant, interesting, engaging way that gets kids out, seeing the value from a firsthand perspective, and really having the opportunity to provide that kind of a supports to the community and really reap the benefits and the feedback that comes with it is really critical. So hands-on education for civics, I think, is a critical, not the critical, but a critical piece of it.
Thank you. Tom?
Sure. I'll just briefly summarize what I wrote, and that is there are pockets of excellence throughout our district when it comes to civics education. And the reason I say pockets of excellence is because there's not a formal curriculum, and that's both good and bad. It lends the experienced master teacher the opportunity to create a program using supplemental materials and really do a good job for our kids. On the other hand, for a new teacher or somebody without the civics background, and many of our teachers are teaching out of their content area, it's up to that individual teacher to collaborate with other teachers or otherwise come up with material or not address it at all. So we need, when we're reviewing, doing a social studies curriculum review, to include civics curriculum as a component of that review and material purchase as well.
Thank you. Ryan?
After graduating from high school, I had the opportunity to live and work abroad in many different countries, South America, Central America, Eastern Europe, and there's a lot that we take for granted here in the United States about how our system works, and I think it's really important that our young people understand that better. It was really fun at the debate at the university to have the number of students that came and were able to interact with the candidates. Also, as a capital city, I think this is also a great opportunity to help us to better link our students to our community. We are the capital city of Alaska. We have incredible resources in terms of civics education, real hands-on opportunities. I think the mayor has done a great job with the Mayor for the Day opportunity. Unfortunately, only a few kids can do that, but I think we have wonderful opportunities here in Juneau, and let's look at a way to use those community resources to directly benefit our students.
Great, thank you. Next question, we'll start with Tom. What would your plan be to address bullying, hazing, discrimination, racism, and sexual harassment in our schools?
1 minute?
Yes.
Okay. Let me summarize on that one, too, just in a nutshell. First of all, we need to examine the data. We can't be shooting from our hip. We had a horrendous event take place earlier this year, and it's easy to react to that, and indeed we should react to it. But how do we react? We need to look at the data. Let's look and determine, do current policies, regulations, our discipline grid, assuming they're implemented as they're expected to be and were meant to be, are they making a difference? What does the data tell us? If the data indicates that there's increases in those types of behavior, then we need to evaluate the policy, evaluate, and by we, I mean district and community and school board, evaluate policy, regulations, and the discipline group to create the best possible instruments we can to address the problem. There's got to be communities out there. I haven't looked for them. That's why I say got to be that are exemplary examples of just those items. They've reduced those behaviors. How do we do it?
Thank you. Brian?
It's a problem that we need to face head on. We have a policy that when you read the policy, it seems adequate. But the implementation of that policy isn't getting us to where we want to be, which is eliminating these ills from our school. So I think we need to revisit the policy, look at the implementation of that policy, but I also think we need to turn to our students. I mean, often, you know, I was a student and I was I experienced that at high school, and unfortunately it's still around. There's a program in our schools called Sources of Strength, and I think that's a good example of using student leadership and students themselves to help us to be able to have them communicate to their peers about some of these issues as a way to augment what we can do at a policy level and sort of an enforcement, encouragement level to really use the strength of the student population themselves.
Thank you. Sean?
Well, it's critical to create an environment, a culture where respect and care and equitability is the expectation. It's the foundation. And I do agree with Tom that, you know, looking at the data is certainly an important part of it. Unfortunately, there's aspects of the data that are not going to be revealed that are really having an impact. And so part of this is just being proactive. You know, when you create an environment and expectations in education on all levels, whether it's with coaches and teachers and peer-to-peer model that Brian talked about, student-to-student, you create a culture of care. And we have some work to do in that area. I think that there's enough data and evidence that came out of this last incident, as far as I'm concerned, that's compelling enough for me to say, you know, enough's enough. And we're going to have to move this up in terms of a priority. I think if you look, for example, at extracurricular activities and coaching, we know some coaches are absolutely first and foremost about creating a culture of care and academic excellence before they even care about the sporting events that they're participating in. That's the kind of behavior we're going to have. So it's really important to reinforce. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This question will start with Brian. Music and the arts can not only help maintain student interest and attendance in school, but has scientifically been demonstrated to develop the brains of young people. How committed are you to ensuring funding for these programs from elementary school through high school?
I am very committed. I currently serve on the steering committee for the Any Given Child Initiative, which is a Kennedy Center initiative in our community that is in 15 communities around the states that's looking at how we integrate arts into our schools. I think we need to be really careful about adding additional mandates, especially when we have a budget crisis or a budget, you know, narrow budgets. But I don't think this is an additional mandate. This is truly important. It's one of the ingredients for creating the capacity amongst our young people to be innovative, which is the key ingredient to later on in life to being productive in the economy and creating new opportunities. So arts integration in our schools is a high priority.
Thank you. Sean?
You know, for a long time we used to think arts and music was just a nice little elective to have on the side, and since then research has proven conclusively that arts and music are so much more than that. With cognitive development, the foundation of how a child learns is positively affected. It, in my mind, has gone from just being an option to being mandatory. So I have been a consistent supporter. I was able to help support the original Jam with Lori and the Glacier Valley Violin Project and others, and will continue to do so. The challenge is we have less resources and less funding for all of our programs, and so I think where the arts and music comes in, we have to maintain it, but we also have to use the community and integrated sort of collaborative efforts with the community to sustain those programs. So that's critical.
Thank you.
I think our community is very fortunate to be looking at three candidates who have a track record of strongly supporting the arts in our community. I don't think you can miss on any one of us three regarding that topic. In times of declining budgets, unfortunately, a lot of districts are very fast to put arts on the chopping block, as we all know. And by arts, I'm including the performing arts, music, et cetera. We have to be careful not to do that, and I'll use Floyd Dryden as an example. We get our FTE budget, how many teachers we're going to have, and if we're reducing by one or two positions or one and a half positions, we pull the group together to a group of staff together to recommend to me, or used to be to me, as principal at Dryden, where do we make our cuts? One of the non-negotiables, if you will, that I would take off the table right away were our arts program, with the exception of culinary arts. We did end up cutting that one. And the reason is because of the significant correlation between overall student achievement and participation in the arts in general. I saw Mr. Brown's flag, so I'll stop
there.
Thank
you. Okay. I can't see his flag.
Oh, really?
I know. While we're on the subject of budget, starting with Sean, if elected, how will you contain costs in light of future budget cuts?
Well, there's a lot of containment strategies. We have, for example, facilities being built and maintained that can have some energy upgrades and may cost initially to have those done. But in the long run, when you're looking at some of the technological improvements of heat pump wells and other things, we really have to start looking first and foremost about when we invest money, not just what's the initial operational cost, but what's the longer-term maintenance and energy cost. And I'm just using that as an example. I think we have to do that across the board. We have to be very efficient about what works. We've got a good data system now in place that's been effective and helping us finally get real-time data on what type of educational approaches and instruction work and what isn't as effective. And we've got to really understand that and go with what's effective. We don't have any fluff. We've lost that time at least 5 years ago, maybe six. It's really down to the core now. So understanding the data, evidence-based practices, not just short-term purchasing items and costs, but what are the long-term maintenance costs and energy costs? Those kinds of things have to be first and foremost. So thanks.
Thank you. Back to Tom.
Okay, at the risk of sounding like a broken record and a cop-out answer at that, let's put aside the fixed expenses of operating a school district. We can't do much other than try to reduce through energy consumption some of those costs. So aside from the fixed expenses, what should our budget look like? And I'm going to go back to my earlier answer. Two items should be reflected in the budget: what our district leadership feels is critical to the success of our school district mission, and the priorities of our community. The community voice, educators, parents, business leaders, everybody in our community should be heard and reflected in the budget. That's why, you know, we're elected to the school board. We're not appointed to the school board. So that sounds like I'm not answering the question. I have some personal thoughts on that. But as far as reducing the budget is concerned, first and foremost, I would turn to the community in the process that we've seen, except make sure that voice is heard.
Thank you. Brian?
I was able to witness the declining budgets over the last 3 years on the Community Budget Committee. In the last 2 years, I had the opportunity to chair that process, which was a great process in that the school board asked for community input. It was a very frustrating process, mostly because we were cutting back budgets, and there really is no quick, easy answer as to, that I know of where to continue to cut. So $11 million over a few years is a tremendous hit to our system. The input from the community, though, is very, extremely valuable, and we were able to get the sense of the community and these trade-offs where they would want to go. And I think we need to do a better job of listening to those, that input, and taking that into consideration on the school board. The largest expense of the school board by far is personnel, and that's also the most important expense. So we need to find ways to keep them efficient, well-trained, and motivated.
Thank you. Tom, we'll start with you with this one. How are you going to address not making adequate progress on the No Child Left Behind requirements?
By eliminating the No Child Left Behind requirement, which is what's happened, right?
Did that work, Chad?
Yeah, that was really good. I wanted that question first.
No, our new system is going to be an exciting one. Our new testing system is going to be an exciting one. When I, you know, flippantly say eliminating the No Child process, I should also qualify that by saying I think it brought about some major needed changes. One is accountability. It's holding educators account. It held educators accountable in a way that we'd never been held accountable before. We had to justify the results come the end of the year, right? The problem is it's a summative assessment. It's just one quick snapshot. We need to have interim assessments and ongoing formative assessments to truly make a difference in education. And that's what I like about the new system. There's a growth factor built into it.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think we're moving away from the No Child Left Behind, but what is really important there is the accountability question and the performance of our students. Our students are doing well if you're in the 80%. But in math and science, we've got only 60-70% that are meeting, are proficient according to the new standards set by our own state. And we have to mention that our state is mediocre across the nation. So it's not that, it's a huge challenge. And I think we want to create opportunities for our most talented students to have to be extremely challenged so that they can reach their potential. I'm really concerned about the 20% plus that year over year aren't keeping up, aren't making the progress that they need to make in order to graduate on time and graduate the skills they need to be productive in society.
Thank you.
So, like most complicated things, it's a mixed bag. I mean, we're seeing unprecedented improvement in our graduation rates, both for Alaska Native as well as non-Native students. Gold stars there for everybody that contributed, and there's a lot of people that contributed to that. We're seeing, on the other hand, a mix of challenge, which is a third of our kids being measured in the type of testing that Tom just mentioned, which I agree is critical. are not making 1 year's growth progress in 1 year's time. That's a huge population. So those kids are going to continue to fall behind. We need effective intervention strategies. I do think that we're beginning to find those. We did have some excellent results in our state standards that are administered through Department of Education that shows that most of our schools are making progress. It has to be a progressive model. We're not going to solve this overnight, but we absolutely have to be accountable to see the progress that's being made. And we need to be addressing all of our children, not just those ones who we know are going to be successful almost regardless of the environment you put them in. So that system is being developed. We're starting to see it take root. It is starting to become successful. We're seeing really positive indicators. We have a long ways to go. And so we've got to continue on the path. So thanks.
Great. Thank you. Even though we have a lot more great questions, but we're about out of time. So please provide your closing statements. We're going to start with Brian, your next step.
Great. Thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight. Thanks for organizing this. I just want to point out that when I lived abroad, I had the opportunity to send my kids to a private school in Belgrade, and in that opportunity served for 2 years on that school board as the chair of that school board. So I do have a sense of what I'm getting, would get myself into as somebody that hasn't been directly involved in education in this way. And I think listening to parents is critical in this process. And engaging our teachers and our faculty. They're the most important part of this educational process, is our teachers in the classroom with our students with the best curriculum and materials. And we need to make sure that those teachers really feel like partners in this process, and that we provide them the support, because with the right support, I'm convinced that the educational outcomes will only improve for our students. Thank you.
Thank you. Sean.
Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to serve again. Having been a lifelong Juneau resident with, five kids and a major stakeholder in the system, what I would like to say is the educational plan that the school board is following is on the right track, and I think the outcomes speak for themselves. The fact that we are increasing student achievement, we're seeing that in almost every school, which was one of our goals. We're seeing high-quality staff through a lot more additional professional development and supporting our staff, which is critical. A community commitment in all of the programs that we have, and we're going to be developing more that really foster the kind of community engagement and supports that we need coming into our schools and working with our staff and our kids are critical. In a culture of service and support, which is the fourth main element within our strategic plan that we're following, is also critical. And we have steps under each one of these that are evidence-based, that are measurable. The area that we have the most work to work, the area that we have the most room for improvement on the school board is communicating what's going on and what's working and what's not. And we need to do some more work on that. So thank you.
Great. Thank you. Tom.
May I simply repeat the spelling of my last name for 30 seconds?
That's what you would like to do.
Okay, yeah. Tom Milliron, fill in the oval, right? But on a serious note, and something we didn't touch on is, what do I feel is the single most important thing we can do to impact our school district and student achievement? I mean, we got to keep the eye on the goals of enhancing and increasing student achievement overall and continuing to increase the graduation rate. I think the first and foremost thing that we can do as a school district is do everything possible to ensure our kids are reading at grade level by the start of fourth grade. Incredibly important. A huge correlation between reading at grade level by the beginning of fourth grade and success at the secondary level. I had another point that Mr. Brown is not going to allow. I'll stop there.
Okay. Thank you all very much, candidates. This concludes the school board portion of our forum. We'll go to music for 5 minutes while the assembly candidates get seated. Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to KTOO Juno. And now we return to the CBJ Assembly Chambers for the League of Women Voters Juno Municipal Candidate Forum.
Welcome back to the League of Women Voters of Juno Candidate Forum for Assembly Candidates. Present tonight are area-wide candidates Maria Gladyszewski, Norton Gregory, and Tony Yorba. District 1 candidate running unopposed, Jesse Keel. And District 2 candidates David Fox, Debbie White, and Joshua Warren. Thank you for being here. As explained earlier, each candidate will give a one-minute opening statement. Then questions will be asked rotationally. The first respondent to a question will have 65 seconds. If any of the other candidates want to respond, each is allowed 45 seconds. At the conclusion, each candidate will be allowed 30 seconds to give a closing statement. George Brown is our timekeeper this evening. He will raise a small flag at 10 seconds left, and at the last second will wave the flag, and then I may interrupt. The questions tonight have been prepared by audience participants and given to league members to give to me. The goal is to ensure a variety of topics are covered. Let's start with area-wide candidate Maria Gladyszewski with opening statements. Please tell us something about yourself and why you're running for the Assembly.
Thank you very much. Thanks to the League of Women Voters for this opportunity and all the people who came and the people who are listening on the radio. My name is Maria Gladyszewski. I'm running for the Assembly because I care about the future of this community and because I think I have the skills and the experience and the temperament to make a difference as we face the challenges and opportunities that we have in the coming year. The challenges that we face, getting the city budget under control, encouraging more housing development, balancing revenues with spending, I think are best met by practical problem solvers who are experienced at working together. And that's essentially my wheelhouse. That's what I've done for my entire career. That's what I did when I was on the Planning Commission for almost 12 years. I'm proud to say that most of the decisions we made as a Planning Commission were unanimous or near unanimous. We listened to each other. We made the decision better by working together, and that's what I would do on the Assembly.
Thank you. Norton.
Well, my name is Norton Gregory, and when I'm elected, it's my responsibility to listen to the community. I will represent a new generation of leadership in our community and on our Assembly. I want to make sure that Juno is an affordable place to live. I want to make sure that Juno remains an attractive place to live for our youth as well as our seniors. Juno is a wonderful community and has a great quality of life. Our community is full of talented and creative people. We have all the amenities of a large city, yet the familiarity of a small community. I want to be an Assembly member so that I can work to maintain our quality of life as well as enhance our quality of life in this community. I come from a different demographic than that of my peers. I understand the middle ground. I'm 35 years old, and I want to gain the experience on the Assembly and plan to stick around and serve for a long while. It's important that all segments of our population are represented adequately on the Borough Assembly. I'm committed to listening respectfully to all concerns and understanding all sides of the community issues before making any decisions.
Thank you. Tony?
Yes, my name is Tony Yorba. I am a private architect in Juneau. We moved here in 1983, raised two boys here, got four grandkids. They moved out of town because of the higher opportunities out of town, and I'd like to see more kids stay here in town. We're going to stay in town here. We bought a crypt at the shrine of St. Therese, so my wife and I will probably be here in perpetuity. So, I'm also a 9-year board member of Catholic Community Services, and that's what sort of makes me unique. I'm in the private sector, both in the for-profit and the non-profit area. And these are two things that I think I can bring and assist the Assembly as they move forward with the decision-making process, particularly in these budget issues. The majority of workers in Juno are actually working in the private sector, and their needs need to be represented. So that's what I'd like to do.
Thank you. Jesse Keel.
Thank you. Let me start by thanking the League and thanking the folks beside me here who've all put in a huge number of hours, a tremendous amount of time running for office. It really is a labor of love. It has been my very great honor to serve Juno for the last 3 years as a member of the Assembly, and I'm asking for the privilege of 3 more years. I want to continue working to try and make Juneau an even better place to live, work, to retire, to raise a family, to start a business. My wife and I have two children we're raising here in our community, and it's with them in mind that I do this work on behalf of everyone here in Juneau. So we have a lot of challenges. We also have a tremendous number of opportunities for Juneau, and I think our future is bright as we stay focused on housing, as we work to return our funding for education back up to the maximum level that the law allows, and to make our budget sustainable as we attract and keep people who in a global economy can really work anywhere. We want them to live here in Juneau.
Thank you. David Fox.
Hi, good evening, and thank the League of Women Voters for this forum. I am David Fox. I'm a retired military veteran of 26 years. I'm 51 years old. I have two sons and a daughter. Two sons live here, daughter-in-law, grandchildren. Wonderful wife I've been married to for 30 years. While I'm running, I'm looking forward to addressing the needs of my community by addressing our budget shortfalls within the city, also addressing our economic development, encouraging more economic development, and also our housing shortfalls. And I look forward to serving the community in those areas, addressing those areas first. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Debbie?
Thank you. Hi, my name is Debbie White. I appreciate this opportunity to get in front of all of you. I've lived in Juneau most of my life. I'm 49 years old. I'm currently a business owner, but I've served my community as a volunteer firefighter and on the board of various nonprofits, Southeast Master Gardeners, Juneau Youth Wrestling, Southeast Board of Realtors. I actually got the honor from Southeast Board of Realtors of the Realtor of the Year, which is not about selling the most. It's actually a recognition of your ethics, honesty, and community involvement. I was involved in suicide prevention at the very beginning of that project. I'm very concerned about the cost of housing in this community. It's an issue I face every day. I would also like to see some improvement in our landfill. I do believe that my experience in the private sector would help us identify some efficiencies in our budget, but we really need to be careful not to compromise public safety, not just our police and fire, but our firefighters, our street maintenance too. Sorry.
Thank you. Joshua?
Hello, I'm Joshua Warren, and I was born and raised in Juneau. One of the reasons I want to run for the Assembly is I've decided to make my home here, and I want to make sure Juneau stays the great city it was that raised me. I also want to make sure the education system that educated me remains fully funded. There might have to be sacrifices made in the city, but education should never be one of those. We owe it to our youngest generation to educate them and help them stay in town. I'd also like to address affordable housing and also opportunity. I have friends who have found the opportunity to work here, but have a hard time starting a family here because they can't afford a house. And there are also those who want to stay here, can afford a house, but can't find a job to work to pay for the house. And I'd like to, on the Assembly, to address both of those issues. And as an economist for the state of Alaska, I also think the Assembly could use some more data-driven analysis of our problems.
Thank you. I'm going to start the first question with Norton. Education and quality of life are at stake. Besides efforts to reduce our expenses, what will you do to increase revenue?
Education is a very important part of our community. I fully support adequate education funding for both teachers and students to make sure that they have all of the resources that they need.
Great. Thank you. Tony?
What we really need to do is to grow. There is an incredible amount of private capital waiting to go and an incredible amount of pent-up demand. If we can align those two things, we'll increase, give an example. In the last year or so, we've 18 months, we've had about 250 housing units built. That adds over $500,000 of new property tax revenue. So if we can keep the momentum that the Assembly has helped in the past, and develop that even further, we have some opportunities to really grow ourselves out of the difficulties that we have right now. I think that's way better than trying to increase taxes or some of the other, the cutting of city government, just because you can only do that so much, and then you have to come back and do that again the following year. And so I think growth is a more permanent solution.
Thank you. Jesse.
Thank you. The challenge, the specific question was to raising revenue. We have a couple of challenges in Juneau with the structure of our budget, where sometimes the growth that is good for our community is not paying its own way. And so we need to look and work very carefully at the structure of our tax system to ensure that the growth in parts of our population or parts of our community that can be so good for our families and for our quality of life, building new neighborhoods also pays the bills that come with it. A new street has to be plowed. When you build up a hill, you have to lift the water, deal with the sewer. And so we need to think very carefully as we work on those challenges to make sure that we don't price anybody out of town or quash the growth. So that's an endeavor we're engaged in now.
Thank you. David?
I'm in favor of the economic development, getting young people to live here. I look at my sons who are minors. Significant imprint as far as economic up to, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of $250,000. I'd like for folks like that to stay here and start their families here. We can't do that with housing shortfalls. It's hard to do that not knowing exactly what our budget shortfall would be. To me, those are economic generators. Things that do not generate are tax increases, public service increases, and cutting our education. So those definitely would be off the chart.
Thank you. Debbie?
Thank you. I think in order to expand our economy, we have a lot of barriers to economic development in our community. There's a huge shortage of land available, and I think the city could let go of some of their property just to allow more opportunity in that area. Because the real key to this is to expand our economy and broaden that tax base rather than raise the taxes on any individual group. Thank you.
Thank you. Joshua?
Like previously mentioned, like I really support growth. Even if it added, though, $500,000 to the budget, we're still not going to hit the $3 million budget shortfall we have. And there's also the issue of how much the cost of that expansion would have. So while I support growth, I don't think it's going to be a silver bullet for the budget. And when it comes to generating more revenues, I think when we look at that, and revenue generation will probably be forced upon us by the budget, that we should really look at the ones that impact the cost of living and stop people from being priced out of Juneau and prioritize so we don't do those things.
Okay, thank you.
The question was about improving revenue, right? Me?
Yep.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the primary method of doing that is to improve our economy and thereby generating more sales tax and more property tax. And we can do that in a number of ways. I mean, one, of course, is to improve the housing availability so that people, it becomes less expensive to live here. We also need to train locals for local jobs. It doesn't even mean more jobs. It means more locals in those jobs. We have at least a third of our, 38% of our private sector jobs are filled by people who don't live here. I mean, so that we need to analyze that again, get some facts, and figure out why those people don't live here.
Thank you. Next question, we'll start with Tony. What should the Assembly do to increase civic participation or citizen participation in local government?
Gosh, you know, if I knew the answer to that, I would be the smartest guy mm-hmm. in the planet, and I would be in demand everywhere. You know, there's some things that we can do, and certainly this venue is one of them. You know, more active interchange between candidates such as ourselves and our population. The difficulty is, I say, is the it is extremely difficult for a person with a job to try to run for office. And there may be something we could do to make that simpler, so that you have a larger pool of people willing to serve. The other thing would be, I really like the interactive nature of Facebook and in the newspaper these days, and the way you can get more involvement with folks that way. And there may be some untapped resources with the new social media.
Great, thank you, Jesse.
Thank you. The it's a very challenging question. Tell you what I've been working on since being on the Assembly. I have a Facebook page. I put out information as much as I can. I've often tried to put out information on what the city's doing that isn't getting covered by some of our traditional media, some of our news sources, and a Twitter feed. More importantly, I also have accepted every invitation I've ever gotten to speak to a school classroom. I think that's very important, to talk with and work with our young people and to meet with civic groups. There's another important thing, though, and that is when citizens come in to talk to the Assembly, whether it's in a committee or at a full Assembly meeting, we owe them the fullest consideration of the points they bring up. They're not going to win every time, but I think it's vitally important that we work with people who do come in and talk to us. They'll tell their friends.
Thank you.
David.
I would like to borrow Tony and Jesse's comments.
Nope, thank you. That's great.
It truly is all about education. And of course, nowadays we have social media, which is a big boon. Things that are contentious in the community, placing those in social media, in the newspaper, explain all sides or show all sides, those types of things. You really... It's not a matter of dragging the citizens in, but it's just simply a matter of just keep educating them, put the word out, showing them what's going on, and at the end of the day, they can make their minds up one way or the other. But.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. I actually get a lot of my news from Jesse's Facebook, to be honest with you. But we do need to encourage more citizen participation. It's something I've just never understood because my parents worked really hard to involve us in what was going on in the world. And I think that a lot of this would be up to Assembly members to help educate the public as to what's going on. Win, lose, or draw one way or the other after the election's over. I've already committed to speaking to several grade school classrooms from the teachers that I've talked to. And I think, you know, we're going to get this okay.
Thanks, Debbie. Joshua?
I definitely agree that we need to use both the social media and continue to use sources like online news and the print news to get out the fact that we have meetings open to public comment and make sure that what those meetings are about is clear, because sometimes there's confusion. There's also the availability of just emailing in your comments. But one part I really liked was like the Juneau Economic Plan. It wasn't a normal Assembly meeting. You were able to go there at lunch. They had meetings in the evening. And you have a whole bunch more community members than sometimes show up to Assembly meetings showing up to give their input. So I think more opportunities for other Assembly meeting, things other than Assembly meetings, for people to give their comments.
Thank you. Maria?
I think there's a tremendous number of things we can do. Inviting, for example, the Juneau the Music Matters, Lori Hagee's thing, brought a whole bunch of people into this room that never had been inside this building and never would have come inside this building if their kids weren't playing violin for the Assembly. That's one thing. Invite people in that don't normally come for whatever reason to hook them in here, but also take these meetings elsewhere. Also, when people do come, as Jesse said, be respectful and welcome them. It is a very scary thing to come into this room. Having spent 12 years on the Planning Commission, we did everything we could to lighten the mood. We even moved the testifying so they didn't have to sit at the scary place. There are a number of things we could do. Thank you.
Well, I'll share my story about how I ended up being involved in our local community government. I first started off with the close-up program, which was in Washington, D.C., and learning about our federal government. I also interned for Frank Murkowski and learned what that was all about. From there, I now participate with the Juneau Affordable Housing Commission. I've served on the commission for 4.5 years. It'll be 5 in January. And what I've realized out of all three of those experiences is that if you want to make a difference in your community, you can get involved and you can join any one of those groups, and you can serve on a local board, such as the Juneau Affordable Housing Commission. There's approximately 34 or 35 boards available, and you can become involved if you want to. You can make a difference and let these students know, these younger people know, that their voice does make a difference.
Thank you. What are your recommendations for serving Juneau's?
Who's it for?
Oh, this is for Jesse. What are your recommendations for serving Juneau's at-risk citizens, especially at-risk youth and people returning to the community after incarceration?
tough nuts. These problems are tough nuts to crack. I think that we need to work as an assembly and as a city to be better partners with the nonprofits that are providing most of those services today, with Juno Youth Services, with Juno Alliance for Mental Health, or Mental Illness, and other nonprofits that do such great work. We also need to work on job opportunities for people who do get out of incarceration. And in fact, recently in considering an ordinance that the police department brought forward, the assembly made a considered choice not to bar people who had recent convictions from working in a certain line of work. That kind of approach, as we partner with the nonprofits that provide direct services, I thought I had 60 seconds, George, is very important.
Thank you, Jesse. David?
I'm in favor of partnering with the agencies that help these folks out. They need to be reincorporated back to the community if they've done their time, so to speak, or whatever the case is. There's absolutely no reason at all that they shouldn't have the help that's needed to via job training or anything like that to help them get back into the community. And partner with at-risk youth or folks who are down that path. I know Big Brothers, Big Sisters is always a nice thing, those types of things. All those should be supported. That certainly lowers that at-risk percentage.
Great. Thank you. Debbie?
I've been trying to follow this story of what brought this question to the surface and the reintegration of people into our community. And it's been rather difficult for me to absorb because when I worked at, I volunteered at Johnson Youth Center in their gardening program, I noticed that the kids were more afraid of me than I was of them. And I think some of this is going to come back to some education with our community members, that these people that we're trying to help aren't scary. And like David said, they've served their time. They made a mistake. And they deserve a chance to come back. Thank you.
Thank you. Joshua?
As the other speakers have mentioned, supporting the nonprofits that provide support services to those currently incarcerated are remarkably important. A lot of studies have shown that the people who choose to use those services while in prison have a much lower recidivism rate. So I really think those have to be the front line of the offensive on helping those people reintegrate into the community. And as far as city employment, not blocking people with previous crimes, but also trying to partner with businesses and encourage them to take positions with them.
Thank you. Maria?
Yeah, the city's role, again, is, as others have said, to partner with nonprofits. They are the ones providing those services. I know there's some controversy about a home for women soon coming out of prison being developed, and people are concerned about that in their neighborhood, and we need to work with those community members and explain the need and that it's, like people have said, that they've served their time. I know the city has offered like below market rates to nonprofits to sell land that do positive social outcomes, like the Cornerstone Youth Shelter.
Thank you. Norton?
I'm giving you a warning.
Oh, that's not sure.
Okay.
All right. Anyway, Juno Youth Services operates Cornerstone Youth Shelter, which the city helped on the land purchase, and that's the kind of thing that the city can do for those kind of services.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Just a reminder, after the raise, you get 10 more seconds.
Okay, thank you. We're all being polite.
You are. Norton.
Thank you. So we need to build strong relationships with the organizations that are already established in our community. And as community leaders, we need to come to the consensus that these are our people and that we need to do something to help them. And that when we help these people improve their quality of life, it improves the quality of life for all of us that live in this community.
Thank you. Tony?
Yes. Children of Incarcerated Parents is a program of CCS in which we helped reintegrate children who lost their parents due to incarceration. So that's something I'm actively involved with on the CCS board. And the one thing about that program and others is that it really relies on others for their funding. And in these days of reduced federal and state funding and the difficulties that, Juno has had with the 5% across the board cut to our nonprofits this past year, it really rings true that we need to make this a priority as a community or the job just won't get done and we'll be paying more in the future.
Thank you. We'll start with David with this next question. There is consideration of changing or eliminating the tax exemption for seniors. What justification is there for this?
There is none. That's it. There is none. You can't take away what the seniors add to our community. Also, and the seniors that I've spoke to, they want to stay here long term, till the end of days, so to speak. We have to make it affordable for them to stay here as well. The Senior Commission on Aging mentions two numbers, 150% and 130%, and it has to do with cost of living and average cost of household, and that's how much we're above the national average. So we have to figure out ways to bring those numbers down for them, and doing away with the tax exemption is not a way for that to happen. So.
Thank you. Debbie?
I agree. There's a lot of different tax exemptions that are available to our community, and I think the senior citizen tax exemption is the very last one that we should be tampering with. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Joshua?
The wholesale removal of the senior sales tax credit, I would agree, is completely not acceptable. A lot of people use the justification of both city budget revenue shortfalls and also just the growing senior population, which is a boon to the community as they provide a lot of volunteer services. But what we need to do before we even look at senior sales tax, however, is look at how the system is currently implemented. As some might have heard, there's outstanding tens of thousands of cards outstanding right now and only 3,000 seniors in the town. So we need to do a reissue of the cards to make sure they're not being used inappropriately and also work on our auditing system to make sure they're being used well at businesses themselves.
Thank you. Maria?
When this is discussed, seniors get nervous. And I first wanted to say that I grew up in a community where my elders, my grandparents were two doors down, and that's what needs to happen in Juneau. We need to keep those seniors in Juneau. They provide tremendous benefit for their families, but for the whole community because they volunteer everywhere. There's seniors everywhere. So we can't do anything to make it any more expensive for people who are living on fixed incomes who have come to count on that exemption. So that's just clear. As others have said, there are other exemptions to be looked at. I know that there's committees going on, and they're going systematically through many of them. And the senior sales tax elimination of the whole thing wholesale is just a terrible idea.
Thank you. Norton?
Well, we have to take a look at our senior citizens and ask ourselves if we're currently doing enough for them. Do we have the proper support and services in place for them? Can they afford to continue living in our community? We all know that there's a serious budget shortfall, but I remain to be convinced that the city needs to eliminate the senior sales tax exemptions. I know that we have a lot of bright people on the city staff and the assembly who can develop and evaluate all of the options before they make a decision on such an important issue.
Okay. Thank you. Tony?
The senior sales tax exemption can't be eliminated for existing seniors. But I'm kind of in line with Norton in as much as there's other things that I think are perhaps more important if the goal is to keep our seniors in town. Because after all, they spend their money here, whether they're sick or they're healthy. They contribute greatly to this community. And one of the things I like to look at is to help the sort of Eden alternative and similar small age-in-place type housing projects in town. I know there's been a lot of talk about larger senior housing projects, but really small scale in the neighborhood is really a delightful idea and something that I think as a borough we need to encourage.
Great. Thank you. Jesse?
The great news is nobody has yet proposed eliminating the senior citizen sales tax exemption wholesale. However, there's been a lot of discussion, and I think it's important discussion to have about modifications. And I will share with you some of the emails that have been coming in to assembly members, coming in from working families who say, you know, when I call an ambulance, God forbid, for my kid, it's not going to come to my kid any faster than it's going to come to a senior who needs medical attention. It shouldn't. But the difference is in who's paying the bill. My street gets plowed at exactly the same rate as the senior citizen across the street from me. But the difference is in who's paying the bill. Now, there's no question that senior citizens are a vital and a valued part of our community and our economy, and we need to be very careful not to price seniors out of town. But it is a vital discussion to have. And I'm out of time to pimp the public hearing on October 23rd, but I hope everyone will come tell us what they think.
Great. Thank you, Jesse. Next question to Debbie White. On the topic of affordable housing, there are a few special concerns. One being that Seattle has a successful housing program for homeless inebriates. Fairbanks and Anchorage have followed suit. Will you support this for Juneau?
I don't think it's the city's job to operate or own such a facility, but I do think that we should cooperate with the nonprofits that are willing to step up and make it happen.
Okay, thank you. Joshua?
I think Juneau needs to be a very strong partner in the Housing First program. I think there are a lot in the community who need the Housing First program and will benefit greatly from it. The city will spend less money on helping them on their day-to-day, both getting picked up and taken to rainforest recovery and other issues. Unfortunately, a facility like that is rather expensive. So while I agree we definitely need to partner with nonprofits, there will probably have to be some city revenue spent in order to make it become a reality.
Thank you. Maria.
Yes, the Housing First model is, I think, a tremendous one, and I agree the city isn't the one to be operating it, but we need to partner with those entities that have been working on this project for a long time. Looking at it is the right thing to do for a whole host of reasons, including it will save money in the end. They didn't have a full accounting of the cost savings, but just the anecdotal, they listed a few clients and how much money they were saving in the first quarter just from two individual people, fewer interactions with the police, fewer times picked up by the inebriate wagon, all of those things, just on one client was saving $7,000 in the first quarter, just on one person. So that's also a good reason to work on this.
Thank you. Norton?
I'm a strong supporter of the Housing First model. Last night, I sat down at the KTOO studio, and there was a roundtable discussion on this exact issue and why it works. And it's housing first. Before these folks can get any other services that they need housing. A survey of 55 people in our community last year, of those 55 people, 40 of them had mental illness. And so we need to make sure that as community leaders, we take a strong stance on this problem in our community and that we realize that we cannot allow people to be homeless in our community. It is simply unacceptable. As a society, when we see somebody on the sidewalk that is homeless, since when did that become okay? Again, it comes back to, as community leaders, we need to come to the consensus that these are our people and that we have to do something about this problem. That when we help the homeless, we improve their quality of life, which in turn improves the quality of life for the rest of us in our community.
Thank you. Tony?
I'm delighted to say that I pretty much concur with Maria and Norton on this and the rest of the folks here on the dais. In particular, the cost savings is actually significant. You've heard this story of the $1 million Murray, and it's really true. I mean, yeah, after a person gets picked up and taken to the emergency room and all these other services, the Housing First is not a wet facility in the sense it's not just like a single resident drunk tank. That the person, when they're ready, has the ability to reach out for resources and actually find a step up in their life. And the facilities in Fairbanks and Anchorage have really good records. And I think this is a real viable facility to have in the downtown, which also brings us around to the real critical issues of how do we make the downtown more livable and a better environment for full-time housing. This is a remarkably good first step.
Okay. Thank you. Jesse.
Thank you. I too support a Housing First facility of some kind here in our community. I think it is really the next step to addressing this chronic problem of those few folks who aren't going to sober up, whether it's for mental illness or just the chronic intensity of their alcoholism and who cause problems. I want to build on what Maria said about some of the dollars, right? We're not going to cut police officers or turn off the lights at Rainforest Recovery Center if it works. So there are a lot of cost savings. It won't pay for itself. So we're going to need to work very closely with our community nonprofit partners, with our federal and state partners who have a lot of the responsibility for some of these social services and public services, because it is a huge improvement in the quality of life and the quality of community for those who walk on our streets and should not be accosted by people who are belligerent or, and frankly, want to uphold our moral responsibility to those folks.
Thank you, Jesse. David?
I agree with just about everybody here. I think we should look at the Housing First model or similar programs that other cities are having success in, and also continue partnering with nonprofit agencies who have experience of dealing with these folks day in and day out and more in tune to what they need. And if we can keep doing that, I think we'll solve a large part of the problem.
Thank you. This next question goes to Joshua. What do you propose to do to implement the CBJ greenhouse gas reduction plan?
I think we definitely need the community as a whole is very good at conserving when the dollar signs demand it. When the avalanche happened and rates went up 500%, our city power usage went down dramatically, 80% or something. We need to work to both incentivize and to encourage people to conserve where they can, and to work as a city. The city does a lot of work both with city buildings and school buildings to make sure that the utilities that don't need to run at night aren't running at night. So there's already a lot of work being done there, but I think we need to work to help incentivize everyone in the community. And I also support things that could lower the traffic on Eagan to try to reduce the amount of cars, both for safety and for pollutant reasons.
Thank you. Maria?
Yes, thanks for that question. I worked on the city's first greenhouse gas inventory, and they did a second one in time to do the plan. And there are very concrete things that can be done. The emissions, over a third of the emissions that comes from the city are from buildings. So that is a big place where we can continue to reduce our energy consumption and continue to encourage or to retrofit city buildings to be more efficient, and also those state programs and other programs that have helped individual homeowners increase their weatherization. It used to be called the weatherization program. So those are very concrete things that can be done and we should do, and we have done as a community: ground source heat pumps on city buildings, support that wholeheartedly, and as we need to work on the transit issues as well.
Thank you. Norton?
I think the first step that we can take is that we need to really listen to the Juneau Commission on Sustainability. There's a commission that is formed and appointed by our mayor that deals with this exact task, and they have some great ideas. In addition, we need to look at our Greens Creek mine. They currently go through 9,000 gallons of fuel, diesel fuel, per day to power the mine. That is a lot of emissions, 9,000 gallons. We need to get those guys onto hydropower all the time. In addition, we have cruise ships that tie up here in port, and when they are here, we have one company that is on hydropower. We need to get the rest of our cruise ships while they're in town on hydropower. We also need to support the company that is being developed right now. It's called Juneau Hydropower, to support additional hydropower for our community. But again, going back and listening to the Juneau Commission on Sustainability and what they have to say.
Great. Thank you. Tony?
Yes, I concur. Maximizing our ability to tap into our hydropower resources is one of the unique things about Juneau. And certainly getting the Kensington onto hydro one way or another is going to be a big step. Likewise, as Norton mentioned, getting cruise ships onto hydro and eliminating the running of the diesel downtown will help the air quality downtown. I've personally been on the design teams for the ground source heat pump projects at the airport and the swimming pool, so I'm well aware of the risks and the challenges and the opportunities there. And so I can really help the assembly in establishing, you know, criteria for those sorts of projects moving ahead. Likewise, on JEDC, we are striving to be the electric car capital of the United States, starting with the first charging station out at Eagle Beach, and I credit Brian Hulse's leadership for that.
Thank you. Jesse.
Well, the suggestion that we listen closely to the recommendations of the Commission on Sustainability is very important, and I second it. I also want to applaud the work that the city's own Green Team, just a volunteer group of employees, does to help us do better as a CBJ, just as a city enterprise, with everything from energy use to recycling. There was one mention of transit, and I think that's important. I think the capacity that we can add to our downtown with a park-and-ride system that is convenient, that is regularly scheduled, and that is affordable can be tremendous, both in terms of relieving parking pressure and reducing those greenhouse emissions. We're doing a good job, I think, as we renovate or build buildings, of looking at the life cycle energy use and things like ground source heat pumps. I am a little wary of getting the assembly involved in who built what hydropower capacity, and that's the limiting factor for Greens Creek right now. I certainly support the goal.
Okay. Thank you. David?
I'm for all forms of renewable energy. However, I also know that there's some sort of cost associated with them as well. As long as the recommendations are reasonable and it's not an added increase to the cost on the city end from a budget aspect, I'm all for it. I think any recommendation needs to be looked at reasonably. Also know that Jesse mentioned building new buildings and things like that. Building those with efficiencies built into them already as far as construction end. That's an incentive to lower any energy cost. I'm also a beneficiary of the incentive for having your house gone through and having your five-star rating or your four-star rating or whatever, and getting breaks for doing that too. So, thank you.
Great. Thank you. Debbie?
Okay, well, it was hard to be first, and it's almost harder to be last. I would say that we have to be really careful with the green technology to not be on the bleeding edge. Ground source heat pumps are pretty good things, but they're really expensive to put in. Since that started, the air-to-air heat exchange systems have come along, and they're considerably cheaper. And the new library could have been done with a series of like 10 of those, and it would have cost considerably less than the ground source heat pump. As far as the energy ratings, the five-star thing, that's actually a state of Alaska function. But I think on retrofitting some of our buildings, perhaps something could be done working with the permit center on retrofitting homes with the air-to-air heat exchangers, maybe a small reduction in the permit or something like that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. This next one, we'll start with Maria. There are 9 members of the assembly representing many Juneau constituencies. It takes 5 votes to move anything. How will you work with divergent views and move issues forward?
It just takes people power and people skills, and it's actually something that I've done a tremendous amount of worked with groups of all kinds, and you know, I'm not a fan of 5-4. I think the decisions are more stable when they're 6-3, even better 7-2, and I think you can achieve that. I think as a community, we agree on a whole lot more than we disagree on, and we need to take the time to listen to each other and work those things out, and that's exactly how we operated when I was on the Planning Commission. There were people, there were builders, there were people on the other end of the spectrum, and we took the time and we listened, and almost never was it 5-4. The decisions were better for it, and the community deserves that.
Thank you.
Well, first and foremost, when I'm elected, it's my responsibility to listen to the community. Listen to the community first. I also come from a different demographic than my peers, as I mentioned earlier before, and that it's important that, you know, We listen respectfully and we understand all sides of our community issues before making any decisions. Also reading our material that's presented by the city staff and making sure that we've done our homework and we understand what's going on. But more importantly, I think that I represent the middle ground and I can see both sides of issues, but I'd like to make sure that, you know, that I read all my materials and that I make the best decision before going one direction or the other.
Great. Thank you. Tony?
As an architect, I've actually made a career out of listening to other people and making their dreams, their ideas come true. And I think as an assembly member, that's what I would bring to the table is this notion of listen, communicate, and collaborate. We really have to listen to what other people are saying and listen to other people's ideas. I've been posting those on my Facebook page. It's really fun. But then besides just listening to other people, you also have to communicate back what you've heard so that everybody is on a common ground and understanding what's being said. And finally, you keep doing that until you really identify that common ground, and that's when you get to really collaborate on a final decision. And that collaboration is what we do as architects and what I'd really be excited to do with fellow assembly members.
Thank you. Jesse?
You know, the dirty little secret, and I don't know if I should admit this, but the vast majority of what the assembly does, we do by unanimous consent. I know, it makes rotten news stories, it really does. But the simple fact is that most of what the city works on, when everybody does listen and does their homework and asks good questions, we end up agreeing on. That doesn't always happen. And when that doesn't happen, it's vitally important that we ask good questions and that we listen not just to the answers from staff and from the community, but we listen to one another and the expertise that each other assembly member brings and their point of view, and that we discuss in earnest and with an open mind. And that can bring us, if not to consensus every time, that can bring us to agreement much more often. It's a good model for our community, and it's a model I hope I've brought and will continue to bring to the assembly.
Thank you. David?
The voters and the folks I would represent in District 2 had the voice first. Saying that, my preference and my training is to take a holistic approach to things. If you use the angle of tools in a box, so to speak, you only get better by listening to a difference of opinions. You can agree in part, or you can agree in whole, or whatever it is you want to take, or you can take some portion of it and make it your own. Working from a problem-solving aspect in that degree is probably the best way to go about it. And you'll find oftentimes you may come in hard set on something, but at the end of it, it might be an idea or two that you haven't really thought about or another angle to go at it. So that's my preference, but people and my voters first.
Okay, thank you. Debbie?
Okay, good job, you guys. Didn't leave a lot left to say. most of what I do every day has to do with negotiation. And the most important thing that I can think of when it comes to this is that you listen more than you speak. It's as simple as that. Listen to what the people have to say and work through, like Jesse said, work through what those differences are and get to the bottom of it. Because I think in reality, we all have what's best for Juneau in mind, and we have a lot more in common than we think. Thank you.
Thank you. Joshua?
As other people have mentioned, we really need to listen to the public, and they should be the first voice, and the Assembly should try its hardest not to contravene what the city as a whole wants. What I hope to bring to the Assembly, if elected, is the fact I've worked with data for 7-8 years, and I think looking at the data of something can help move a debate away from an emotional debate to more understanding the facts behind the debate and the facts behind the choices that the Assembly should make, and helping to take those facts to the public so they also understand why the Assembly is making the decisions it makes. The other thing, though, is I think compromise is a beautiful thing, and I don't think we can allow perfect to be the enemy of good. While everyone has their perfect situation, I think if we can make small steps together, we can continue to agree and do a lot of things by unanimous vote.
Thank you. Okay, Norton, next question. What concrete steps can the Assembly take to reduce the high rates of domestic violence and sexual assault in Juneau?
You know, as far as concrete steps go, that's going to be a tough one. But I think that, you know, quoting the Juneau Empire's August 8th article, Police Chief Bryce Johnson said that our community has a real disconnect between what they perceive our problems in our community to be compared to what the police see as problems in our community. So we need to make sure that we educate our community as to what's going on in our community and the steps that can be taken to reduce those problems. And I think that it all comes down to education and really making sure that everybody understands what the real problems are in our community.
Great. Thank you. Tony?
Yes. Working on Catholic Community Services, we deal with this quite a bit in the Child Care Family Resources Division, really the little victims of domestic violence. So the idea would be to try to prevent it where we can, and certainly it's known that a good job, an affordable house, and affordable child care can help reduce some of the stresses in a household. And I have to say I had the tragic responsibility to close Puddle Jumpers, a quality daycare in this town that we could no longer afford as an agency. And it broke my heart because I know there's people that can't take a job now because they lost that child care. So the idea is, how can we expand the pool of subsidy to allow for additional daycare, for instance, and that's a challenge for the Assembly because it's a difficult goal, but it's a real concrete thing that I think we could do to help prevent some of the situations that cause domestic violence.
Okay, thank you. Jesse?
Not the easiest question of the evening. I'm proud that the Assembly in, I believe it was my first year, partnered with AWARE to apply for the Community Development Block Grant to expand their services and the transitional assistance that they have to help people who've been victims move out into more stable situations when they've gotten free of their abusers. And I think that certainly we can work with and need to work with JPD and with AWARE and other advocates to make sure we're doing the best job we can be and that we're doing right by victims. Prevention is always harder, and I think that some of our school district programs have been good. Those are, of course, not Assembly programs, but things like coaching boys into men, things like Girls on the Run. We can also work to make sure we have women well-placed on city commissions and boards and advisory groups. And then, of course, as someone mentioned previously, housing and the ability for folks to get out of a bad situation and not be trapped quite as badly are all very small steps we can take.
Okay. Thank you. David?
I think it's a combination. Certainly education from the youngest age possible, that it is certainly not an acceptable behavior. You hear things like that all the time. But I think just as important is to talk to nonprofits that daily deal with these problems, get their takes on them, look for grants or opportunities to increase daycare programs, whether in-home or established institutions. Jesse and Tony said, to get folks out so they know they have a stable platform for their children and allows them to work at the same time. And also look at ways that we can continue to assist things like Boys and Girls Clubs, those types of things that offer positive role models for children that are successful in those situations later on in life.
Thank you. Debbie?
I think the real key is education so that this no longer becomes socially acceptable, because while it's not acceptable in this room, there are neighborhoods that it's just part of everyday life, and I think helping change that perception from people is really important. As far as the question was, what concrete steps can the Assembly take? And so I'm thinking that maybe we could have a small contingency of people from the Assembly going out into the community and helping with these educational events or presentations in schools and things like that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think with a lot of the societal and cultural problems in the city, the Assembly's main direct action is to help support the nonprofits that are there with the people and helping them directly with their services. Places like Aware have done marvelous work in that field. We also, as mentioned, need to do education so that kids know to report it and kids know that it's not acceptable. As mentioned earlier, if we reduce the where the cops need to work downtown to help with certain issues there, this is where that savings disappears, is because we can, instead of letting go of the cop can now spend more of his time dealing with issues like this instead of dealing with chronic inebriation downtown.
Thank you. Maria?
I agree. I agree that a big part of what the Assembly can do is to support the nonprofits, places like Aware. It's also true that we need to make sure that our prosecutors, our city prosecutors, and our police officers are well-trained to deal with these issues. I was a victim advocate for rape and domestic violence years ago, and the way some of those victims were treated was astonishing to me. And I don't think we do that here, but I think that there's always improvements that can be made in that arena, and we need to make sure that domestic violence is prosecuted vigorously, and I believe the city attorney's office does that, but also the way they deal with victims who are trying to get out of that is something that is under the Assembly's control, and we need to make sure that those people are well-trained and do everything they can to let the person know they can get out of that situation.
Thank you. Next question goes to Tony. What are your ideas to address the issues surrounding our city's biosolids and waste management?
Yeah, great question. A tip of the hat to Jesse because he has spent quite a bit of time on this. I have a fair amount of experience with it myself, just personally dealing with in projects on landfills. And I think the thing to do is to find the solution that is right for Juneau, whether it's a more aggressive and sophisticated incineration system that allows us to capture some of that heat that's just flaring off out there. It just drives me crazy every time I see that out there. I will say this, that recent policies, including the curbside pickup, has done a remarkable job at reducing the totality of the material going to the landfill so that the problem is diminished in the sense of the overall volume. Whether we have to go to a baler system like other communities have done and ship that material off or develop another landfill someplace else in the borough, these are all questions that I think the Assembly is going to have to deal with in the future.
Thank you. Jesse?
Thanks. It's a vexing, it's a rotten, stinky problem is what it is. The one moral victory of my first term on the Assembly, and I won't claim anything like exclusive credit, is that we no longer put an entire city's worth of sewage sludge in one neighborhood. That was wrong, and we don't do it anymore. On the other hand, shipping it south to somebody else's specialized landfill leaves us at the mercy of other folks, and what makes this problem hardest to solve is that the city does not own the landfill, and we don't own the right to pick up the garbage. So we've made very small and incremental progress with things like the city's recycling drop-off. We're doing, I think, a much, much better waste with hazardous waste pickup or hazardous waste collection days. We have a consultant's report that will come soon for a more sustainable solution, a more long-term solution for our biosolids. We need to remain vigilant and keep working toward a solution for the garbage, but I don't have one yet. I wish I did.
Thank you. David?
I think it's a part of an education problem. Is certainly I encourage the recycle programs already in place. Also, it's a problem that's faced throughout the southeast communities. There's nowhere, I mean, being largely isolated or island communities one way or the other, there's really nowhere for things to go. So recycle is certainly a big part of it. Lived for a while in Kodiak. The recycling community was largely driven by nonprofits because they gained a portion of doing things like can pickups and bottle pickups and things like that, and they got a portion of the proceeds to simply help them run their programs. So anything we can do to incentivize those types of things to get people to realize that we just simply can't keep dumping, you're going to run out of real estate. And you're right, it is a rotten, stinky problem. I agree with you, but certainly also look at systems that would. Okay, I'm done.
Thank you, Debbie.
Okay, this is obviously a regional problem because we're not the only city in Southeast Alaska to have it, but we're specialized in that we don't, as Jesse said, we don't have the certificate of convenience or we don't own the landfill, and I guess there's some sort of statute that we can't have both. What we're stuck with is our choices are burn it, bury it, or ship it. And I'm looking forward to finding out what kind of ideas they've gotten into this so far, and let's get something done, because frankly it stinks, it's an embarrassment, it's leaching into the wetlands, and we should be embarrassed. So,
thank you. Joshua?
It's definitely a very large problem for the reasons stated, mentioned that we don't own the landfill or the right to collect the garbage. I think what we need to do, and it's not necessarily the assembly, but curbside recycling has worked wonders, but I really think as a city we need to greatly try really hard to reduce our waste stream until further technologies can come into the field that will work for our waste stream. We can't buy the landfill and incinerator because that leaves us beholden to the landfill. If it needs repairs, they'll just come back to the city and say, repair this or it's not going to be operating anymore. As far as the biosolids, I'm also very happy we're no longer adding that landfill. That wasn't acceptable, but I don't feel that shipping it south is acceptable either. So we really need to find a way to either burn it and deal with that waste or look at the other measures, turning it into fertilizer and such.
Thank you. Maria?
I know this is an issue people have talked about forever and make fun of the landfill. And as has been mentioned, we don't own the landfill. We don't have the ability to pick up the trash. So we have a disconnect between our goals as a city, which we all agree on, which is to reduce our waste and to do something about that landfill, and our ability to affect the change that we want. There was a solid waste plan done in 2008 that started to be implemented. There were many public meetings, many hours of meetings, listed a whole series of actions, and one of them, the recommendations, was to obtain the certificate of public convenience. Aero Refuse at the time was saying they would negotiate with that. It went on for several years. They wound up asking for $15 million. The disconnect is we want to keep the community. We don't want to pay a lot to give up our trash, but we want to do something about it. Those are two competing goals, and it's a difficult problem.
Thank you. Norton?
Well, the issue of waste management is one that is very near and dear to my nose. I work in Lemon Creek, right down the street from Wells Fargo, near the brewery. I have a view of Siegel Crest from my office. And we need a total comprehensive solution to deal with this problem. Gas plasma technology has come a long way, and it should be considered. It's recently been reported that in Sweden, 99% of their refuse is reused, and it's about time that Juneau makes a change.
Okay, thank you. I think next question, next question goes to Jesse. Last year, the Assembly replaced two sitting planning commissioners who applied for reappointment for the first time in at least 12 years, citing many applicants. What is your philosophy on appointments to boards and commissions?
I was a dissenting vote on that, and I being an incumbent on a board or commission is not a lifetime sinecure, but neither ought we shoot volunteers lightly. So I think. That it was an unfortunate move, and what we need to do is we solicit people to pitch in and do a colossal amount of volunteer work on behalf of our city, and it is huge. Maria's nodding over here; she's done it. We need to think carefully about the expertise they develop and to give that value, just as we do with the expertise that citizens bring in. And so we need to move carefully and thoughtfully with our commissioners and our board members, especially on those empowered boards. We cannot treat that lightly. They do too much work to simply throw them over for simple reasons.
Thank you. David?
I agree with Jesse in part. The amount of work that gets done is tremendous. But also at the same time, I could understand possibly a term limit of sort. Now, what that would be, there's no telling. The assembly members run for 3 years. I know from running anything for 3 years, you truly do get to develop a good expertise at that point. You spend a certain amount of time learning, if for anything, and then you become very knowledgeable about the subject that you're dealing with. Is 5 years a good term? Perhaps, but I think there should be something in there, if nothing else, just to bring in new ideas and that type of thing.
Thank you. Debbie?
Okay. When people volunteer to serve on these boards and commissions, they are giving up a great deal of their personal time. I did serve on the Board of Equalization for several years, but I have to admit at some point you can end up with somebody on these boards and commissions that's no longer effective. The Assembly does need to have the ability to remove those people, but the fact is we have a hard enough time getting enough people to sign up. There's been more than one time that even after I stopped serving on the Board of Equalization that I was called and asked if I would please consider doing it again. And so, you know, we have to keep all that in mind.
Thank you. Joshua?
I think we definitely have to respect the volunteers who take that amount of time and want to serve on these boards. As to what my mindset would be towards appointing to people on these boards, I really think we need to make sure we have differing opinions on the boards so that we don't have one subgroup of people who represent a subset of the community having most of the power over like an empowered board. Realizing that there are limited volunteers, having all people on an Eagle Crest board be complete patrons of those, I think could change the view that board will take towards serving the rest of the community.
Thanks. Maria?
There was a time when you were on a board, you didn't even almost have to reapply to get your position again. I don't think that that's a good thing. I think that when your 3 years is up, I think you should have to apply with everyone else because you should have the opportunity to talk to the Assembly and for them to possibly rebalance if everybody has the same views. But I absent some not showing up for meetings or something like that, if the person is a contributing member and they have been a good member in good standing and continue to contribute, I think that should be given a lot of weight. And there are term limits. It's 9 years. You only get to serve 9 years. That's plenty of time. That was instituted when I was on the board. I actually served longer because I was grandfathered in. But it does take a while to learn the ropes. It takes several years. It's a complicated board. The Planning Commission particularly is a complicated board.
Thanks.
I believe that it's important that we have representation from all segments of our community represented on all boards, whether it be the Assembly or the Planning Commission or the Affordable Housing Commission. It's important that we hear the ideas from all segments of our community. We're a very diverse community, and the boards and commissions that we have should also be diverse to represent our community.
Thank you. Tony?
Yes, I've been selected for boards, and I've been passed by, but I never felt that it was something other than what was in the best interest of that organization. And I think that's something that I would want to carry through in the Assembly. And I would suggest that you do sort of a similar process to the way the Bureau does its procurements through a sort of a mini RFP process, which would allow each time a person, the most qualified people to be selected. And so, for instance, if I was on a board, you know, for my term at the end of 3 years, then I would go into the pool of likely candidates and the best qualified person would be selected each time. I think that's a good way to refresh boards and also make sure that new ideas come in and that, you know, you maintain a fresh chemistry in the board.
Okay. Thank you. Next question goes to David. What specific criteria should we use to judge whether the road north is worth it?
So is that a for or against the road question? It's the loaded question.
I have no idea. I did not write the question.
I'm for access road, for road access. However, I'm also for new ferries. I'm for all Alaskans having every access available to their capital that they can. I look at it as certainly building the road, but once that's done, looking at what we need to do to take care of our ferry systems. Southeast operates on ferries. We have no choice. There's no bridges to anywhere or roads to anywhere for us, not in this particular instance anyway. So I think it's an equalization of both. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Debbie?
I am also for having more road access and cutting down the length of the trip time that you have to spend on the ferry. However, this is something that's going to take a lot of time. I truly wish that the road had been built in the 70s because we'd no longer be fighting about it. The divisiveness that it causes in our community is pretty sad. We have to remember, though, those ferries are like 50 years old or older, and they're not exactly fuel-efficient machines. I don't remember the exact mileage of what they get, but it's an astronomical amount of fuel, even to take the Lakani from Juneau to Haines. Anything we can do to cut down the use of the fossil fuels is a good thing.
Thank you.
I think the Juneau Access Road is something that neither the city or the state can afford. The ferry system overall, by the study, has shown that maintaining and improving the ferry system will be cheaper than maintaining the road, especially if the road winds up being year-long. I also feel the need to respect the recreational value of Berners Bay, the cultural value of Berners Bay, and I'm also very concerned that if the Juneau Access Project was built, that we might lose or greatly reduce the ferry traffic from Juneau to Haines and Skagway, and I'm worried about the foot traffic and bicycle traffic and the availability of them to get to Haines and Skagway like I did when I was in Boy Scouts.
Thank you.
I think the question was about what criteria should... What was the question?
What specific criteria should we use to judge whether or not?
Yeah, I mean, cost is a big one. Are northern legislators going to really allow an appropriation for that kind of money for Juneau? I mean, the worst thing that I think could happen is if we started and couldn't finish. I mean, I think, so do we have an assurance that that's going to happen? Is the road what are the costs to not only build the road but to maintain the road? And what are the costs to this community specifically? Even if the road magically appeared, we're already struggling with our services. We would have to then provide basically ambulance services into the Haines borough because they can't provide the ambulance services because there's a ferry. So, I mean, cost, practicality, will of the community, will of the region is another one. We've been beating each other over this issue for decades, as we've said, and it is... a difficult issue, and people simply don't agree.
Thank you.
The specific criteria that we should evaluate are the safety of the road, the cost of the road, but also the economic benefits that building the road may provide for our community. As many of us know, the city attorney has reviewed the legality of building the road and has determined that the road is legal. The assembly has voted that the road is legal, and the city has issued a permit for the road. At this point, it is now a state matter. And so it all comes down to, you know what, the economic viability of building the road and the economic benefit to our community.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, I'm inclined to agree. Really, at the end of the day, the main criteria, because this is a state project, there's, you know, Juneau doesn't have the dollars involved in this thing. So it's a state project. So really, it's what's in the best interest in the state of Alaska. And that... we being the capital for all of Alaska, for all Alaska citizens, we have a responsibility to make sure that if the state of Alaska, the rest of the state, wants to put out the millions of dollars for that road because they believe that it provides better access to their state capital, that we need to take that very, very seriously.
Okay, thank you. Jesse, quick response.
Thank you. You know, I think we should look to its impact on the region. I think the damage to the economies of our neighbors in Haines and Skagway really speaks to their tremendous opposition. I think we should look to the long-term sustainability of the ferry system, which would functionally immediately lose three more votes in the legislature for its ongoing funding, weakening Wrangell, Petersburg, Ketchikan, Sitka. I also think we should look very hard to what Maria mentioned, the costs to the city and borough of Juneau for ambulance service out there, for more police out there. You know, the notion that the Coast Guard might provide the medical care when there's a wreck out there, I think is incorrect. And so that cost then falls to the property taxpayers and the sales tax burden here in Juneau. It not only does it not make sense from a cost-benefit analysis, it doesn't make sense from a social policy analysis, but then I've run out of time.
Thank you. So we've unfortunately run out of time. We're going to start with closing statements, go in reverse order, starting with Joshua Warren.
I'd like to, as my closing statement, thank the League of Women Voters, thank K2 for broadcasting it, thank the people who came here tonight and all the people listening online. I'm Joshua Warren. I'd really like to serve on the Assembly to help restore education funding, help make it so people in my generation can start families here, and make sure people in the older generation can afford to stay in Juneau. And I'd appreciate your support on October 7th.
Thank you. Maria?
Oh, no. Sorry. Debbie.
Oh, okay. So, thank you. My name is Debbie White, and as you've heard, I'm also interested in being on the Assembly. I really appreciate this opportunity to be here tonight and meet some of you face-to-face. I've tried to keep to myself a little bit. I'm fighting a cold right now, so I'm not 100% up to speed. Feel free to email me, call me, or meet up with me anytime, and I'll be happy to talk with you in more detail. And no matter who you want to vote for, please vote on October 7th. Thank you.
David.
Thank you again for the voters, folks listening on the radio, and folks staying this long simply to listen to what the candidates have to say. As a District 2 rep, I look forward to working with the Assembly to certainly lower our budget shortfalls, but most importantly, increase our economic development. And I'm committed to a better Juneau. There's a reason that slogan is on my cards. It's on my flyers. I'm committed to work taking the time to make that happen. I look forward to your support on October 7th. Thank you.
Thank you, Jesse.
My thanks again to all of you and to the League. I'll answer the question you didn't ask. I hope everyone will vote no on the question of an empowered board for the pool. I think the last thing we need as we try and tighten our budget is another vertical silo to make administration less efficient. But I do hope anyone who ever has questions or issues with how the Assembly runs or what the city's up to will call me. My cell is 209-7910. And I thank you all for the honor of serving on the Assembly. I respectfully ask for your vote on October 7th.
Thank you. Tony.
Yes, and for radio listeners, again, this is Tony Yorba. We may be able to hold back our budget imbalance for another year or two by spending some of the easily accessed budget, but really the low-hanging fruit is really gone now, and what I think we really need to press forward with is to look at growth-oriented solutions for our budget, which is really the big issue. I have a strong background in the private sector, both in profit and for-profit. The great news is that Juneau has the power to create its own growth to get into that growth cycle. I've gone through growth cycles, I've gone through lean cycles, and I much prefer the growth cycle. So again, if that resonates with you, Tony Yorba on October 7th. Thank you.
Thank you. Norton.
Over the last few years, there's been a lot of effort and focus on housing matters in our community. I want to make sure that we maintain our focus on housing and that we stay on course. It is absolutely vital that Juneau has affordable housing for all segments of our community. Young families need to be positioned so that they can build equity. Senior assisted living and housing for seniors is important so that seniors can remain a part of our community. Having an affordable home to come home to and to live in is an important part of our quality of life. Increasing the housing supply in our community will help to enhance our quality of life by offering increased choice in housing and will also build our tax base, which will help with our current city deficit. I respectfully ask for your vote on October 7th.
Okay. Thank you, Maria.
Thank you, Maria Gladyszewski. Gladyszewski, it's easier to say than it looks. This is an exciting time to be in Juneau, and thank you to the League and to all of you here and to the people still listening on the radio. It's that is one thing that makes this community such a tremendous place to be, is people willing to volunteer, people all throughout this community. And I would be honored to serve on this body to continue my volunteer service to this community. I hope you vote early. Vote. I'm from Chicago. Vote early, vote often, I guess, is what I should say. No, just kidding. But truly, thank you for all the work that all of you do on behalf of this community every day, and I would be honored to serve as your representative on this body. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, candidates, for your participation. Special thank you to K2 for airing the forum, Sonia Larson at the station, and Jeff Brown, and another special thanks to Beth McEwen for help with the space and sound tonight. Thank you, League members and audience participants, for the volume of questions this evening. Additional information on the League of Women Voters is available online at lwv.org or junolwv.org. Please remember to vote on October 7th. If you will be out of town, you can cast an absentee ballot at the Assembly Chambers or Mendenhall Mall. For the League of Women Voters and K2FM, I'm Allison Curry.
This is KTOO News Juno. Thank you for listening to the live assembly, CBJ Assembly Chambers for the League of Women Voters Juno Municipal Candidate Forum.
To demand greater political freedom. The protests began last week over China's recent rejection of free elections for Hong Kong. We'll go to Hong Kong for more after headlines. Afghanistan's new government has signed an agreement to keep 10,000 U.S. troops in the country. The deal came a day